quote, "All you can do with Bitcoin after you buy it is sell it." Well, yeah, that's exactly what you do with money. This is Dear James Woods, a Guy's Take episode. What's up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. This is a Guy's Take episode, and it is going to be a response to, and I hope this is in very good spirits, and I don't want to be demeaning or anything, because I hope, you know, maybe James Woods gets around to actually listening to this. I don't have a whole lot of hope for Peter Schiff at this point, but he was quoting Peter Schiff. But for those of you who don't know, and I will have the link in the show notes so you can check it out, there is James Woods retweeted an article, or tweeted a link to an article from Fox Business that quoted Nouriel Roubini and Peter Schiff multiple times in it, which anybody who's a Bitcoiner knows. They are hilarious and very old-time Bitcoin trolls, you could say. The article was titled, "Bitcoin is no match for gold in a coronavirus world." But in his tweet, he quoted one of Peter Schiff's comments from the article that says, "There's no real use for Bitcoin. All you can do with Bitcoin once you buy it is sell it, but you need somebody else to buy it from you. It's a massive pump and dump." Now, this is a very typical fallacy that requires that the critic here not look at any other money, to focus only on Bitcoin and try to come up with the reason why it's not valuable, and to really try super, super hard to not think about what the underlying value proposition for money is. Now, I'll start with saying I have a lot of respect for James Woods, and I also have a lot of respect for Peter Schiff. You know, a lot of people give him crap because he's a super Bitcoin hater, and I know a bunch of Bitcoiners have their panties in a wad about Peter Schiff. But he was actually really pivotal in my discovery of Austrian economics early on. And honest to God, I can only really thank him for that. And, you know, I think it'll take, in my opinion, or for me, it'll take a whole lot more than some ignorant tweets about Bitcoin to lose sight of the value he gave me coming from that perspective. And honestly, it doesn't surprise me in the least that people are skeptical of Bitcoin, or that people rage and hate on Bitcoin. This is absolutely nothing new. In fact, the anomaly of today is that serious people are actually taking it seriously. This has been the story of since I got into Bitcoin. I've been around for 8 or 9 years, and it's only been 3 or 4 years that people have actually talked about it as if it was anything but a complete joke, a complete pump and dump. Not new, you know. I find it very interesting that Peter Schiff basically has known about it since I have, and is so hard-headed that he actually is not and will not even come around to taking a closer look at it, but then instead just doubles down. But you know, whatever. But I have a lot of respect for him, for his economic takes and everything else. And James Woods in particular also is very good on, like, he sees the corruption in the system. He understands that there are massive fundamental problems with the government and stuff. So I got a lot of respect for him too. And I know he's intelligent. I know they're both very intelligent people. But that said, both this article and the tweet could really not be more ignorant about the issue. From the context of Peter Schiff's quote, I think his entire understanding of gold's monetary value pretty much starts and stops with the word tangible, and then assumes the rest of its value with a series of fallacies and poorly thought out justifications for that, that actually don't hold up against even the slightest scrutiny. Like the base arguments that are constantly made about, and made over again in this article, don't hold up for 20 seconds with a little bit of monetary history. It's amazing that they harp on these over and over and over again. But if you actually look and then question why it is that they don't hold up, you'd actually find a really fundamental truth about money. So I hope to kind of dig into that a little bit in this episode. That's the goal of this. And maybe one of them, or neither of them, you know, who cares, will actually stick around and listen to it. Now, for all of you Bitcoiners out there and everybody who is holding Bitcoin or already interested, you know, you came to Bitcoin Audible, so you're probably already there. And for those of you who are, we have two wonderful sponsors who have amazing products for using and holding your Bitcoin. And those are Hexa Wallet, which is a wonderful non-custodial mobile wallet. It's a great entry mobile wallet to really begin to, you know, hold your own keys and do so in a very safe way. And it's got a really clever backup system and a lot of features in it. And then our other, and that, again, that was Hexa Wallet, by the way. If you want to check them out, go to guyswan.com/Hexa. And then our other sponsor is Shift Crypto, and they have a wonderful hardware wallet that I am loving more and more, and it is the Bitbox O2. A really secure and open source, by the way, hardware wallet is the best way to really hold your Bitcoin cold storage. And this one is super simple, minimal across the board, and I love it. I'm a big fan of minimalism, and it's really just a great little hardware wallet. Check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox. So much love to our sponsors for making Bitcoin Audible possible. All right, so let's dig into this article a little bit. I'm not actually just going to read the whole thing. And Fox Business is about the most annoying website in the world. I can't stay on it for more than 5 minutes without it refreshing and sending me another pop-up and then trying to start the video again. Coming up with notes for this episode has been the biggest pain in the butt. But let's start it out. So the recent surge in Bitcoin's price has created some new believers, but the cryptocurrency will never supplant gold as a store of value or medium of exchange, some Wall Street investors say. The cryptocurrency's price has soared more than 70%, blah, blah, blah. It's about $18,000 a coin, which I think right now we're a little bit higher. I think we're 18.5, 18.6, somewhere in there. 18.670, so just shy of, we're moving. And this, of course, will come up later in the article, because it was clearly volatility means that it can never work. I really wish some of these criticisms would get more interesting or, like, go another level deeper, because when you get the same shallow arguments for 9 years and it keeps not being true for 9 years, it gets harder and harder to answer those questions again. But we got a lot of new people, a lot new to the show and a lot new to Bitcoin. So we'll go back through it. We'll skip down a little bit and hit the last paragraph of this one. It says, this is a quote from Peter Schiff, to try to act like Bitcoin is some kind of improved version of gold. It's going to disrupt gold because it's a better store of value. It's a better medium of exchange. All that is pure nonsense, says Peter Schiff, CEO of Westport, Connecticut, based Euro-Pacific Capital. It's not a store of value because it has no value to store. All right, so let's stop there because there's already a lot to unpack. So let's go ahead and just start with the quote that Woods put in his tweet. Quote, all you can do with Bitcoin after you buy it is sell it. Well, yeah, that's exactly what you do with money. And it's also the vast majority of the market for gold. But this is literally true of every currency. I mean, without any caveat here, that is the role of currency. That is the very raison d'etre of currency and money. You know, sometimes I genuinely wonder if people think about the statement after they say it. You know, seriously, what do you do? Tell me what you do with the dollar. What do you do with the yuan? What do you do with the yen? What, you know, do you, after you buy it, do you wipe your butt with it for a few days before giving it to somebody else? Maybe you roll it up and snort some coke with it. But, you know, what about the points in your bank account? What do you do with those? You trade them. That is literally what money is. It is the good with the highest set of assurances about the fact that it will retain its value and its rule set so that it can be securely exchanged. It's like an economic promise. And how well do you know that this money will sustain that promise? And this is what differs. This is what makes one money a good money and one money a bad money. This is what makes gold a great money, or has historically made gold a great money and a great store of value. It has very, very good properties to secure that promise. fiat has crap properties. It works great until it gets corrupted, until the very securing of those rules get abused for the people who are securing it, or supposed to secure it. But right off the bat, this is one of those fundamental, like those core mental framings that just shows you how little smart people who have thought very deeply about other things and, you know, probably work very hard to understand things in the world, but it reveals just how little, if any, they have really thought about money. What is it? Why is it? And what makes one money good and another money bad? What makes one money more valuable than another? So let's take that. Let's take that comment of all you can do with Bitcoin after you buy it is sell it. Except the fact that this is true of the dollar. This is true of yuan. This is true of essentially all money in the world. This is a characteristic of money. So then we can begin to ask the question, why does the dollar have a multi-trillion dollar market cap? Why is it the global reserve currency? And why is another currency, equally fiat, equally abstract and virtual, not have that same level of dominance? Because there you will find interesting questions. There you will find interesting answers. But stopping it, all you can do with Bitcoin after you buy it is sell it, gives us absolutely nothing. Why do you buy the dollar with your labor? Especially when all you're going to do with it is sell it later for goods. So hold that thought. Now we're going to move on to the next one. Quote, it will never supplant gold as a store of value or medium of exchange. Okay, well, obviously someone with a podcast titled Bitcoin Audible is probably going to disagree with this statement, but let's break it down. First, gold is not a medium of exchange. Hasn't been for a really long time. Funny enough, this is actually a role that Bitcoin can fulfill in the digital era, which gold cannot. Lightning, the protocol on top of Bitcoin, for instance, is a brilliant protocol for establishing private, liquid, instant, non-custodial payment networks that span the entire globe. Something that you can't do with gold or dollars, actually. And the combination of Lightning plus many other layered technologies on top of the Bitcoin protocol, let's take like side chains, like Liquid, the state chains application. Another really interesting example is a fascinating new development, which just kind of happened recently, is the idea of the shadow chain, which is actually implemented by Lightning Pool, which actually allows any arbitrary application to execute a Bitcoin transaction, again, non-custodially, which, again, no money in the world can boast this except for Bitcoin. If you're doing this with dollars, if you're doing any sort of smart contract or long-term agreement or multi-sig agreement, it only is because your dollars, if we're talking about gold or dollars here, it's only because your dollars or gold are with a custodian. That's the only way you can do it. Yet you can do this natively in Bitcoin. So coming from a position of whether or not something can be a medium of exchange that can actually have a global payments protocol built on top of it so that you can trade it back and forth incredibly quickly for low fees, and you can do so without any borders at all, or at least as if they don't exist, there's no contest between gold and Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the only one that can do this even close. Gold can't do this even remotely. That's why we don't use gold anymore for basically anything except, you know, storing it away in a vault somewhere. For the one thing that it is still good for, it's monetary assurances. But we'll get back to that. So I'd say it's pretty clear Bitcoin has a rather immense potential to technically be a medium of exchange. And being both open as a network and open source as software, the fact that it is entirely permissionless, so I could code right now on it and, you know, create a wallet. I'm not good at it. But anybody can. It's permissionless. You don't have to call up AT&T and be like, can I play with your network? And that it is programmable basically means that any clever middle school coder on the planet can essentially prove him wrong by building anything that you can write with code. So to say Bitcoin can't be a medium of exchange, throw the let's halt on the idea of it storing value, but just the idea that it could fulfill the role of medium of exchange, is a little bit like saying fintech cannot meaningfully impact an economic medium of exchange, that it is not useful for payments or for consumer transactions, which I think, like, right on its head is clearly kind of a silly thing to say. Because we're talking about something that can be coded, something that can be programmed, that you can run any arbitrary application on top of, that you can build entirely novel payment protocols on top of, that has and continues to have massive amounts of development in exactly this regard. It just seems ridiculous. You need to go deeper if we want to have a discussion about this. But let's just go back to gold. So gold cannot do any of this. Gold can literally do nothing interesting from the exchange side, from the multiple owners side, from the custodial side, unless it's in a bank, unless you give it to someone else. So in that case, literally, if you're just talking about a bank making you able to digitally transfer something on their ledger, well, then literally anything can be a medium of exchange. Like, if you're using the bank as the intermediary, they could be holding whatever the hell they wanted in their vault. You could trade gravel or butterflies. It's completely arbitrary. You're just trusting that the bank is updating some ledger and keeping something safe for you, which is exactly how gold got corrupted, why it failed as money, because it doesn't work in the digital age, because it sucks as a medium of exchange in an economy that's actually digitally and globally connected. So trying to compare Bitcoin and gold here, gold is a resounding loser in that comparison. Like, Bitcoin destroys it when we're talking about a medium of exchange. Now, there's something else to be said about store of value, just a simple sense, before we get really deep into it, it's worked pretty well on a medium to long-term frame for over a decade. So saying it doesn't store value when we're a hair's breadth away from the all-time high and essentially 99.9% of anybody who has ever invested a dollar in Bitcoin would be profitable right now, that's increasingly a difficult thing to say as well. You're gonna have to try harder to rationally defend that today. And then if you want to talk about inflation rates when we're comparing monies, just on the general sense, again, we're accepting that all you can do with money is buy it so you can sell it later. It's a tool for trading and storing value. Well, what's the monetary policy? Well, there's nothing with a better monetary policy than Bitcoin that is decentralized, that you don't have to trust someone else to take care of or to secure. It's not a promise by some authority somewhere. And Bitcoin has got almost the exact same inflation rate of gold. So historically, and from a reasonable perspective, just looking at monetary policy, again, we'll ignore all the fact that it's not tangible, it's just digital points, which is absolutely right, and I understand the skepticism. But if we are just looking at the monetary policy, the inflation rate, and then the ability to technically implement a global medium of exchange, Bitcoin is a pretty clear winner on all of those. Granted, the inflation rate of Bitcoin is roughly the same as gold's, but gold's is unreliable. If the value of gold goes up, more people mine gold, the gold inflation rate changes. Bitcoin, I know what the inflation rate of Bitcoin is going to be in 30 years. I can tell you right to this day, and guess what? It's going to be a hell of a lot lower than it is today. But we've got something a little deeper to hit about the store value idea. Because undoubtedly, this is not going to satisfy someone like Peter Schiff, and I'd expect someone in James Wood's position to also be not convinced at this point. But I think you can safely say that the idea that the only thing you do is buy it and sell it is that, okay, well, we're talking about this thing as a money. So, duh. That's what we do with it. You need to drop that argument. That argument doesn't mean anything, because if that argument was actually held true, the dollar literally couldn't work. And I would also argue that gold is completely valueless if, and that's all you do with gold, but there's a caveat there that undoubtedly they would bring up, so we'll just wait until we get to that point. So let's move on, because that's literally the next point we're going to get to. So the very next paragraph, quote, Gold, widely viewed as a safe haven, for investors seeking to preserve wealth during periods of market upheaval, such as the coronavirus pandemic, has value not only in trade, but its use in fine jewelry and electrical conductivity. We're coming back to that in just a second. Bitcoin, generated or mined by the verification of transactions in a blockchain digital ledger, has no use other than as a limited medium of exchange and has historically been subject to wide price swings. So first, absolutely true statement is that from a technical standpoint, we can make Bitcoin a medium of exchange, but clearly right now it is limited. It is a network technology. So it's like a social media with, 20 people on it. It's like, oh, I can talk to anybody in the world. It's like, well, no, you can't. Like the social media platform, the technology could allow you to talk to anyone in the world, but there's only 20 people on the social platform, so you can't. And so in that sense, the Bitcoin technology and the protocols that we can build on top of it, yes, could be technically a medium of exchange on a global level. And obviously any sort of fintech that we can build on top of Bitcoin. But right now, clearly the network is limited, which funny enough is actually one of the things that makes it a great store of value. But we'll get back to that. Because right now I want to focus on the comment that gold has value not only in trade, but its use in fine jewelry and electrical conductivity. This drives me crazy. This, in my opinion, and again, I want to, with as much respect as I can to these people, is one of the most historically ignorant comments about money that you can probably make, and completely falls apart as a principle so quickly. So first, electronics. They use gold, yes. Copper, tin, lead, lithium, ceramics, silicon, plastics, silver, nickel, aluminum. There are literally thousands of inputs used in electronics. But no one would say that any of these things make a good store of value because you can build computers with them. And despite the fact that you can make all of these things also beautiful and shiny, including plastic, only a couple of these are used as jewelry. Why? Because jewelry is explicitly a display of wealth. Jewelry is made of valuable things. Things aren't valuable because they can be used as jewelry. Take moissanite, glass, even plastic can look exactly like a diamond from a reasonable distance without close scrutiny when you put it on your finger. Now to think this is the core difference, that this is the crux between what makes a gold valuable and a Bitcoin not valuable, is to literally ignore a billion things that can serve both of these roles. Use in electronics, use for some other reason, or be made into jewelry or made it shiny. I mean, imagine glass was as durable and as or more scarce than diamond. It would be used for jewelry all over the place. But what's the difference? The scarcity and the durability. This type of thinking is perfectly backwards, and a simple, very simple history lesson shows it. So where does jewelry come from? What's the origins of jewelry? Wouldn't that be a relevant history lesson here? So let's go back. Let's go long, long time ago, back to the era of the Kula ring, which we have talked about on this show and dug in a couple of pieces, Nick Szabo's piece and another that I can't think of off the top of my head. But this is in Papua New Guinea, and this is an ancient trade ring for a very culturally tight set of for islands. And they spent massive amounts of capital and resources traveling from island to island in this cycle to trade seemingly worthless trinkets. There were necklaces and bracelets with beads, and a lot of these things were passed down for generations. They would wear them on their person because the humans during that day, our species, was far more mobile. We carried our wealth with us. This was literally the only safe way to carry our wealth. This is where it came from. And then it quickly became a way to display your importance, your wealth in the community as well. But the trinkets themselves, had no real beauty. They would, not as we would think of it, they weren't explicitly shiny or, you know, produce any light or something like that. Like, they were just basic beads and simple things. But they displayed wealth. They displayed importance and authority in the community because they were the money of the time. Now, beauty is subjective, obviously. What one culture values, another hates. But this worked. These things operated as money for centuries. And this is why it was secure for as long as it was. It was because of the strict cultural values were part of a closed system. And it was not until outside influences and outside technologies, like so many across history, actually, this is the story of all monies that died. Some new technology or some new culture mixed and basically destroyed the element of scarcity. And in that is a really profound lesson about why very, very tight cultures that were closed off from the rest of the world could use certain monies that actually weren't scarce, but were scarce within their communities. And also a really fascinating lesson in how money scales society is that within a culture of trust and where everyone has the same values and knows the same quote-unquote fictional truth, if you would, about what the rules of society are, within that, within a community where you can trust and know the other people in your society, very different, very abstract monies can operate successfully for an incredibly long amount of time. Rhinestones on the islands of Yap were another fantastic example. Again, they worked for like 5 centuries, and it wasn't until they began trading with other societies outside of their cultural boundaries. That is how gold and silver became such great monies historically, is they did not require that cultural tie. They were not abstract. They were tangible. And in that tangibility, and in the fact that there was no technology that could get around the scarcity of silver and gold, that tangibility gave or enabled a degree of assurance as to its characteristics that nobody could cheat, and specifically was able to bridge distrusting cultures, distrusting societies. You could trust the properties of the gold. You could trust the properties of the silver instead of having to trust the person you were trading with. This is how you grow society from Dunbar's number, where you have to know the relationships and be able to trust with who you're trading with and know whose debts are good and whose aren't, to something that has millions or even billions of people working together. People you don't know, people you don't speak the same language of, people you have nothing culturally in common with, but you have a common medium of exchange. You speak the same economic language. That is the role and power of a money that has independent assurances that you can rely on. And gold provided that. Gold provided that because it was tangible, and because you knew its tangibility defended it from being faked. Still wasn't great. There were plenty of times in which it was faked, in which there was coin clipping, in which there was inflation, in which there were lead coins that were coated in gold. Still to this day, it's a huge problem. It cost a fortune to try to verify a gold bar. But nonetheless, it works a whole lot better than beads or seashells or wampum, you know, whatever it is, all the other historical monies that essentially collapsed in the face of it when the two monies were integrated into society, and we ultimately led to a single global monetary standard, which was gold and partially silver. Okay, so a little bit of history lesson there. Jewelry came about because something became money, not the other way around. And again, the other point, there are a billion things that can be both jewelry and like shiny and nice and pretty looking and also have tons of other uses. I mean, shit, you could argue that wheat has multiple great uses. Therefore, it could be a store of value. And yet it's terrible at that job. And there's a very explicit reason why. And we're going to talk about it in just a second. But I got to take a break, and we're going to talk about our sponsor for today's episode really fast. All right, so many of you are experiencing your Bitcoin bull run for the very first time, and you're seeing what may have been a small or moderate amount of money become a lot of money. It's time to start thinking about cold storage. That is where our sponsor Shift Crypto with the Bitbox O2 comes in. The standard for solid Bitcoin cold storage is a great hardware wallet. The Bitbox O2 is a secure, open source, Swiss made, and minimal hardware wallet. I stress this a lot just because it's my favorite thing about it. Both the design of the hardware itself and then the software interface is just super simple. And I really like the micro SD card backup. So you have something physical to keep safe rather than a piece of paper with seed words written out on it that if somebody even just sees it, well, then suddenly it's compromised. So if it's time for you to get a hardware wallet or for you to get one for a friend or family member for the holidays, check out the Bitbox. Go to guyswan.com/bitbox, and that'll take you right to them so you can check it out. And of course, it will let them know that I sent you there, which is a great way to support the show. All right, so immediately the next comment or quote is by the other king of the no-corner trolls, I guess you could say, Nouriel Roubini. Everybody loves and knows him. Is, quote, "Crypto is the mother or father of all scams and bubbles." But then the immediate paragraph afterward is that Roubini last week tweaked his view on Bitcoin, telling Yahoo Finance the cryptocurrency might be a partial store of value because of its limited supply. Interesting. This is a really interesting caveat given by Roubini, which I never expected any seeding of anything from him. His amount of hate, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't believe that it's worth anything still, but that is at least a recognition that there is something more to a simple, oh, it has no value, like Peter Schiff's comment. And of course, I would say, well, if it has no value to store, you know, why is it $18,000 of Bitcoin right now? But I know that's not going to convince anybody who is skeptical, so I guess we can just leave that alone and we'll come back to it. Crypto is the mother or father of all scams. Now, from somebody who's outside of it, and like this is a many, many, many days, weeks sort of discovery, or I guess you could say lesson to dig into as to why this is not a hypocritical statement. But it is not, but someone from the outside is probably going to make that assumption, and it's probably going to sound very much like it is. And that statement is that, and I will back this up as best I can in a short time period, that statement is that crypto in general, yeah, it basically is a giant scam. Bitcoin is not. To somebody outside, that sounds like my digital thingy is great and everybody else's digital thingy is doo-doo. Which essentially every single person who has invested in any crypto is making that claim, or typically does. So I understand the immediate, probably potent response to, oh, now he's just full of crap. But let's dig into it just a little bit. Again, let's talk about what money is. Money is naturally a network phenomena. It is valuable because of the number of people who use it. It is useful, the utility of money, in the fact that you can buy it and exchange it with somebody else and that it stores value in the interim, is based entirely on the size of its network. Gold that has five people accepting it as valuable is worthless. It is inherently not going to have any value. It is going to carry an incredibly low price because nobody accepts it. It is the network that gives money its value, and it is the network that allows money to do its job. So the purpose and role of money in society, the thing that is the consequence of the ability to buy and then sell it later and not lose value in the interim, the thing that that then fulfills for society is that it solves the double coincidence of wants and enables the specialization of labor. It is the reason why you can learn to do one thing, I can learn to do something entirely different, but we have this middle good, this this one resource in the middle that we can both exchange for that has the best assurances, the best promises that it's going to keep its value and it is going to maintain the same, it's going to be the same good it was tomorrow as it was today, so that you can make shoes and I can make shirts and one of us doesn't have to be naked from the ankles up or down. So it's a networked phenomena. It is valuable because of its network, which means that inherently having thousands of networks means that it can't do its job. Money and all communication protocols will inherently tend toward one. This is why things like Facebook, Google, TCP/IP, these communication protocols, VHS versus Betamax, you end up getting one standard and it's almost impossible to undo. It takes massive amounts of pressure to undo these things. Same thing for, you know, electricity, AC versus DC. We don't have like a bunch of varieties of electrical networks. We basically have one grid and it all speaks the same electricity. So again, it's a network. And what makes one money good versus another, what made gold and silver better money than copper, than fiat, up until the digital age, of course, was the degree of assurances it gave, was the fact that it was a tangible, explicit atomic structure that took massive amounts of resources and energy to try to create more of. Therefore, it was provably and incontestably scarce and independent of anyone being able to create it. Fiat, somebody can just, with a stroke of a pen, create billions or trillions of units. Gold is immune to this, and its tangibility is explicitly what makes it immune to this. It's because we know it is a thing in the real world, and we can verify that thing. Its tangibility is how we give it, or how we know. It's the reason those assurances exist. That's what makes historical monies that were the best tangible. It's not because tangible things create good money. Plenty of tangible things are garbage money. It's because being tangible is a prerequisite to having those high assurances. And it has been up until very recently in the digital sphere. Enter Bitcoin. Suddenly we have a digital network that whose ultimate value, the reason this thing is valuable, is because it has equivalent and extremely powerful assurances in the digital world that previously could only be produced tangibly. So how secure is a transaction after it's settled? How do you know it's done? How well can you trust it? Do we know tomorrow that what I'm holding on to is going to be the exact same thing and part of the exact same whole that it was yesterday or today? That it requires my explicit signature? It is explicitly me who has to give up its ownership for it to move? That the rules that define what that currency is, that how much of any subset of units this thing is, that operate this entire system, that they work as intended, and that the spirit of the contract will match its execution. Can anybody else modify it? Do I have to trust a bank to do so? Do I have to trust some judge to agree with the rules of Bitcoin in order for the rules of Bitcoin to be valid? Do I have to hope that the president doesn't sign an executive order to undo it? Does it work differently? Is it under a different set of rules depending on what country I'm in, what jurisdiction I am under? Ask those questions about owning gold in a bank. Then, if you aren't, you know, completely ignorant about how Bitcoin works, ask those same questions about Bitcoin. It's pretty clear if you understand how it works, if you understand that nobody can cheat it and nobody is in control of it, you understand that Bitcoin provides these assurances in a remarkably novel way and something that nothing else can compare to. And that is just the beginning of it. That's the tip of the iceberg. So this is all to get back around to crypto. So this is the value of money. Money is a network. Money is a language. Its value is explicitly in the number of people who use it and in the fact that it has assurances about how secure and how independent and unchanging the rules of the money are. It's how safe and secure you know the promise of what it is remains so. Gold has very high assurances in that realm. In fact, arguably, and I'll completely concede to this point that it is it has a higher assurance than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is still experimental. It is the first thing that has any assurances in the digital space. And because of that, it has vastly more utility than gold in that way and can become a technology like a medium of exchange and fulfill that role and do so non-custodially. But it's harder to trust. It is in the end code. It is a protocol. And even though it has a more explicit and predictable monetary schedule, right now it makes perfect sense that some people still only trust tangible gold. But crypto is just an attempt to get greater influence over the money. It is a reversal of the very idea of money. It is, I am going to make some sort of a network that does a thing, and then that is going to try to imbue my money with value, rather than the idea that the only reason we have a blockchain is because it makes the money secure. If we didn't need it to secure the money, we wouldn't have it. Crypto flips this on its head, and it tries to copy and paste and create new money, which really, if you really dig into all of this and look at where all of these projects originated and what they're trying to do and the arbitrary, completely insignificant changes they're trying to make in an effort to hype it up as if it's better or it solves some horrible problem of Bitcoin, when the entire reason of Bitcoin is to secure a monetary policy. It's an attempt to bring back seigniorage. It's about control over money and making enormous amounts of it. So they have a different vision for the money. Remember, money is a collective thing. It's something that allows people to work together and trust this independent totem. To create your own money is a great way to say, trust me. And of course, Bitcoin is open source, so all you have to do is copy-paste. Copy-paste, change a couple of little arbitrary parameters, and suddenly we've got a new money that, oh, it does twice as many transactions. Yay! So they have a different vision for the money, one that's quote-unquote better in their subjective valuation, and they want influence. They want to be the ones in charge. They want to make it right. They want to make it the correct money as they see fit. And of course, they want to be the large stakeholder. They want to be the one that got it at 1 cent before it went to a dollar. So, and they want to be the one that decides what the inflation schedule is. They don't have to cooperate with other people on the independent network that everybody is already using on. They want to be the ones that decide how much the inflation is and how much goes to their very important role in the network. Just like Bcash is such a great example right now. They're trying to implement a tax fundamentally at the protocol level to pay a very specific and tiny group of people to work. That's not an independent money. That is a politically controlled, arbitrary network. It is software that is just dictated by a handful of people. They want to be the central bank because, damn it, it sounds like a great deal. Of course they do. But look underneath the 10,000 claims of all the crypto crap out there. Oh, it's faster. It's got more widgets than yours. Our icon's cool AF. You know, team's got a really strong roadmap, really great community, super, super great leadership. Fees are so tiny, you need a microscope. You'll see it for what it is. They want to control the money, and they want to be the early adopters because they missed it with Bitcoin. Well, from their viewpoint, technically, you didn't. Bitcoin simply won't give them the control and won't give them the history that they already missed. But in the end, it's just code. So why not copy, paste, and tell everybody that mine's better? But if the value of money is in its network and its assurances, look at the crypto again. Look at the rest of it, and you realize that every one of those sales pitches, which are the sales pitch of all 10,000 of them, more transactions, it's faster, it's got more widgets, it's got cool website, look how great our team is and how clear the vision is, it's got tiny fees. All of these things specifically degrade those monetary assurances. Bigger blocks means it's harder to verify with every passing day, which means the rules could be completely changed and completely arbitrary. The smaller the fees, the less secure it is. The more inflation is needed, and therefore, the less secure the monetary policy is. The more explicit the leaders, and the more explicit the team that's in control of it, the easier it is to politically change the rules, to just have them decide whatever the hell it is. It's not independent, it's theirs. The more widgets, the higher the attack surface, the less reliable the cryptography, the more ways you know, or the more ways we don't know how it could be destroyed. You don't build arbitrary widgets into a cryptographic protocol, something that's trying to secure the fundamental value in the network. For the same reason, you don't have an operating system that you can install, that it's connected to the internet, and you can install thousands of apps and video games on, as the firmware for a rocket ship, for something that lives depend on, the launch software. You don't put arbitrary crap in that. You build a hardened, absolutely simplified, as reliable as possible, always will do the exact same thing, has three different routes, and it's only three different routes. You build the most concise, simple, and trusted piece of software you possibly can, because if it doesn't work, everybody dies. That is what this is. This is a foundation. This is infrastructure for a new money and economy built on top of it. There's going to be an entire financial system on top of this thing. It must do tomorrow exactly what it did today, and it must have the smallest attack surface possible. It should only do five things, because every new thing we allow it to do is a new way that it can break, is a new way it could go wrong. So when Crypto 576 is bragging about having 1,000 widgets built into the core protocol, think of it as 1,000 ways that you could probably kill the thing. And because it's a network technology, because it's like making a new MySpace or making a Facebook copy pasta, it has no staying power. Unless it can provide something fundamentally different or better and higher assurances. It's largely the complete misunderstanding of what the money needs to do, what the foundation of it should be focused on, and what the very assurances, what the incredibly novel and fascinating thing about Bitcoin that it can provide that nothing else can, particularly in the digital space. The very revolution of Bitcoin as a cryptographic system was that it created a digital unit that was immune to replicability. You can't copy-paste it and think that you're creating the same thing, because that's the very thing that Bitcoin solved, is the fact that it is a thing in the digital space that you can't copy and paste. A hat tip to Parker Lewis and the amazing Gradually Then Suddenly series. It's like 15 articles, and he goes into so many of the fallacies around Bitcoin. I'll link to that series. I've got the whole thing in audio if you want to check it out. I'll link to that in the show notes. But let's keep going. I think I've hit crypto enough. Hopefully, that's really only the beginning of the story. There's also more added reasons that the network is valuable that something like a social media doesn't have, that a language doesn't have, even though it has all of these actually in common. Like, it actually has the barriers that make it difficult to have a competing social media. Money has that, the barriers to having multiple languages. Money, the network of money also has that. The barriers of like a measuring standard, like, you know, using inches and feet instead of centimeters and meters. That is all wrapped up into money. And then the fact that it is built on a set of assurances. It also has the Lindy effect, which any forking, any like consensus break to one of these digital protocols is explicitly a destruction of that. So one of Bitcoin, the reason you can trust Bitcoin, or the reason people are increasingly trusting it, is because it survived for a really long time with the exact same consensus rules. That is one of its most potent ways to convince people that it is trustworthy and that it will remain. 21 million units, the current inflation schedule, all that good stuff. When you break consensus to change the protocol, well, you've thrown it out the window. anybody who can't verify the code themselves and actually walk through and see that it's secure has to trust based on how long it survived. If you split it and change the rules, you've started that from zero. Then, of course, there's a shelling point. There's all sorts of stuff. There's a million other things to get into, but hopefully that hit at least a small introduction to why Rubini's technically right. Almost the entire rest of the crypto space is basically a scam, and Bitcoin is not. Sounds like a hypocritical or ridiculous statement from somebody who is saying this digital token is better than this one, but it's got an enormous and very powerful reasoning behind that statement. I wish it could be covered in 5 minutes. Now, there is something else about Rubini's partial concession, I guess you could say, that because of its limited supply, Bitcoin can be a partial store of value. And I'd be very curious about the actual conversation, how much he was hating on Bitcoin when this was actually said. But this is really funny because if you start asking that question, why would something simply having scarcity or whatever, why would that provide value? You know, like what would that really do for a money? And of course, I've talked in this episode highly about the fact that this is assurances. This is about how well you can know the rules and how independently they are identifiable and whether or not you're trusting a person versus the actual network and the rules itself of Bitcoin or the money and, you know, another case, gold. But somewhere at the heart of that, you can ask, why does fiat work? Why did fiat work? That's a really important question. You know, fiat, like the dollar backed by gold, worked for almost a century. So why is it failing now? What went wrong? You know, nobody was redeeming their gold so that they could make electronics in, you know, 1905. And yet people were still using paper certificates that were backed by gold. What does gold sitting in a vault under the ground, not moving, not doing anything else but being boring, reliable, not going to change gold, do? What does it provide? Because it backed a paper currency for an incredibly long amount of time and worked very well outside of the times in which it wasn't properly aligned to the amount of gold, which is really funny that those are the times explicitly that it started to fail and didn't work. So again, why is it failing now? Why does fiat eventually fail? It's not because it's not tangible. It's not because it's virtual or that it's merely points, that it's merely digital points. And it's also not because you can't do anything other than trade with it. It's because it's corruptible. It's because its assurances suck while it's paper. The rules have no guarantees. It's because it changes to benefit those who control it. It's because it's provably unfair. Because we have to worry about executive orders. We do have to depend on the judges. We do have to know what jurisdiction we are in. We do have to trust the banks. We do have to have someone else to store it for us in large numbers. Because we must use custodians to do anything interesting with it. And we have no say whatever over the monetary policy. Not only that, we can't even audit the central bank once. But of course, we'd have to trust a third party to do it anyway, much less, obviously, we could not ever be able to audit the central bank every 10 minutes, every day on our home computer, which is the equivalent of what my Bitcoin software is doing right now. While I'm recording this and not paying any attention to it, my Bitcoin software is securing and making 100% sure that the central bank of Bitcoin and the network that we are all on has an unchanging, perfect monetary policy that is accurate down to the 1/100 millionth of a Bitcoin, and that nobody has cheated it. And if anybody does, I just evict them from the network. I simply stop talking to that node or to that computer, and I keep talking with everybody who is following the rules. I don't even have to know that it happened. It happens automatically. I run the entire central bank of Bitcoin on my home computer. So think about this. Let me ask this question to anybody who's still trying to wrap their head around this with fiat. So why did fiat work while it was backed by gold? If it was never corrupted, if you could not make more fiat than there was gold in the vaults of all of those banks, which is what happened every time we had some, you know, huge bubble and then collapse, is it was almost universally a credit bubble where they created way too much debt. There wasn't enough gold to back it. They manipulated prices, and then basically the bill came due one day and it was like, oh snap, ain't nobody ever gonna be able to pay that back. There's not enough gold, crash and correction. That continued until we got off the gold standard and they found out, well, we can just print fiat money indefinitely. We can do it forever. We can manipulate all prices. We can push everybody into debt 10 times, 100 times more than we could when we were on a gold standard. And we have an unlimited check. We have a blank check to buy and do whatever the hell we want. We can fight 10 wars at once. We have no restrictions because money is arbitrary. It is via the authority vested in us. So what would happen if we were all using paper currency? It was perfectly one-to-one backed by gold in vaults all around the world, and there was nobody who could get into them. It was perfectly and absolutely secure, and it was counterfeit proof. We knew nobody was counterfeiting it. And we were using this currency, and it was working great, just like the dollar was on the gold standard back in the day. But then one day, all the gold just vanished. No gold. Gone. All the vaults, all the deep bunkers and everything were empty. But they had been sealed shut. And we could still verify and fully know whether or not it was a paper note that had been backed by gold and had not been backed by gold. We knew the difference. It still couldn't be counterfeited. But nobody knew the gold was gone. Would it stop working? How long, if it remained counterfeit proof, if it remained true that you couldn't make any more of it, and that you could easily distinguish between a fake one and a real one, how long would it keep working? What would make it stop working? There's a pretty strong analogy here that Bitcoin is the assurances of gold, as if it was backed by all the gold in all these vaults and you knew exactly how much it was and you could prove that it couldn't be counterfeited, except the gold was just never there. It's just the assurance in and of itself. All right, we're going to have to keep going because I'm almost out of time here. We're just going to skip over a little bit of stuff. It's not a very long article, even though I've managed to go on forever about this. Bitcoin is not a good store of value due to its volatility. Oh man, this one doesn't get old. Again, very lazy thinking. Volatility is a consequence of liquidity and size of the market. You can't make it stable before it's a highly liquid market. Like, it is because it's a highly liquid, highly accepted market that it loses its volatility. It's volatile because it's global. It has real prices that cannot be subdued by printing more Bitcoin. The supply is inelastic. It does not change. It's also very young and has completely independent infrastructure. It's its own network, top to bottom. And it's a new asset, and it's growing like a freaking forest fire. So saying it's volatile is the most duh sort of statement that you could make. And it will continue to be until it reaches maturation, until it has a massive and stable global infrastructure, people stop finding more ways to use it, until we stop programming more functionality, or until it's got so much functionality already that the additional functionality being programmed into it is only 1% of its current functionality rather than orders of magnitude of its current, like something like a Lightning Network. It will still be volatile until people understand just how valuable its assurances are and get them. They understand why it's better than fiat. And it won't, it'll be volatile until fiat currencies stop having screaming volatility on their way to zero. Until treasury bonds stop going negative, until we stop having global credit crises and we have stop having large countries engaging in insane capital controls and about 100 other things. Yeah, after those things are through, it'll be a lot less volatile. The simple truth of the fact is that new things are volatile. New things have volatile prices. Immature markets have volatile prices. Novel assets that don't even know exactly where they fit into the traditional valuation concepts have volatile prices. And things that change rapidly and where development is growing very quickly also, you guessed it, have volatile prices. The key difference is that Bitcoin's volatility is on the way up. Fiat has volatility going down. We live in the age of volatility. The whole world in 2020 is the definition of volatility. The real question is, do you want that volatility to be growing your value or destroying it? Because, like I said earlier, we are right on the cusp of an all-time high, and basically 99.9% of the people who ever bought Bitcoin are sitting on profitable volatility if they were holding it. So this isn't the greatest argument for 2020. All right, that's enough of that. You should listen to Bitcoin is Not Volatile by Parker Lewis in the Gradually Then Suddenly series. Don't remember which one it is. It's like number 5 or 6 in the series, I think. Again, links in the show notes. But basically, Bitcoin has been volatile for a very long time. It is increasingly less volatile, and it continues to go up in spite of it. All right, so now we're back to another Schiff quote. Go figure. Quote, a lot of companies that were kind of jumping on the Bitcoin bandwagon back in 2017, they have all walked away, Schiff said. Nobody is interested in Bitcoin anymore as a payment method. Good old Schiff, never fails. I'm probably going to have a special episode dedicated to him at some point in the future, but first, that's because Bitcoin is still in a monetization phase. It is very hard to encourage people to spend something when they can see that the infrastructure around it, the technology around it, the protocols on top of it have collectively grown 10x or more since 2017, but that the price for that entire span has basically bounced around the $9,000 to $10,000 range for better part of 2 years. The price rise we are seeing right now is the market playing catch up. It's catching up with development, the increased trust in the system, the new applications, the further tests and proof that Bitcoin isn't just going to be arbitrarily changed and it isn't going to break tomorrow morning that has come with time, the new applications on top of it, and the broader network and usability. Like he said, it's a very limited medium of exchange. Well, it's a lot less limited than it was 3 years ago. Now, second, they actually mentioned PayPal in this, they said, quote, because PayPal just adopted Bitcoin, allowed you to buy Bitcoin and other crypto in the app. And they said, quote, all transactions with those sellers, however, will be settled in fiat currency. Now, this is where the beauty of Bitcoin and a lot of development in Lightning Network, I think, is really going to come into play. So right now, those merchants are settling in dollars. And the network effect and the shelling point of dollars is almost insurmountable. It will be a massive fight to overcome the dollar standard. And they are exactly right about that. But this is going to flip, and not in the way that I think Bitcoiners typically say. There's a service called Strike, and I think it's the canary in the coal mine for what I believe the real future, or at least the first move for the future of Bitcoin, the Bitcoin Lightning stack, has in for us. An infrastructure inversion. Now, we saw this same sort of infrastructure inversion with the internet, how everyone continued to use their corded phones. I'm sure Peter Schiff used his for years before finally breaking down to the smartphone scammers. Everyone kept watching their normal old cable TV, using their analog phone, analog TV antennas, etc., etc. The back end of those feeds went digital, and they never saw it happen. One day, they were picking up their corded phone, thinking that an analog connection was being made at some switchboard, but really, it actually went to a local node that turned it into packet switching, shot it across the internet, and turned it back into analog at the other end. Same thing happened to cable and broadcast television. So Strike is a service that integrates with my bank account and allows me to spend over Lightning and Bitcoin as if it is dollars. Now, one can argue that this won't be maintained. Obviously, this is just for Bitcoin enthusiasts right now. Until you begin to just think about what it would be like if other companies adopted this same sort of strategy of settling with Bitcoin, but keeping balances for their customers in dollars. Now, you'd probably say two things. One, transaction fees are too high, and B, too much volatility. Except that volatility is can easily be countered with futures markets. That's how any Forex market or whatever operates. You buy an equivalent contract on some currency so that you can make a business deal, so that if the currency goes up or down, it doesn't matter. You bought a hedge that will basically make your profit and or loss equal, so that you made the deal at an explicit price, even if it took some span of time to actually go through. That is the point of an options contract. Well, speculation is also often the point, but this is what you can use. You use it as a hedge. What do we have in Bitcoin now? Continuing to grow and maturing futures markets for Bitcoin. This means that you can settle payments in Bitcoin and on Lightning very easily. And then back to the point of fees. Lightning Network has tiny fees and has massive potential to enable thousands, tens of thousands of transactions per second, competing with Visa, and then potentially, as soon as we're getting towards that era, surpassing Visa in a major way. But those two things alone would not cause it to happen. It wouldn't simply be that we could easily settle in dollars and that we could do it for low fees. This is the magic sauce. Imagine. Venmo cannot send money to Cash App. They're two different networks. You have to withdraw to your bank, wait a couple of days, send it to a different bank or send it to a different service, and then deposit. I'm back on the other end, pay a fee both ways, and usually wait days to settle. They are closed networks. They don't talk to each other unless they are within the same company. Otherwise, you have to go back to the banking system, wait for a settlement, and then go back out of the banking system to the new network. They are all separate from each other. Same thing goes for PayPal. You can't send from Cash App to PayPal. You can't send from a Visa preloaded card to Apple Pay and hold a balance. You can't send from Apple Pay or Google Pay to Zelle. All of these things are walled gardens. But PayPal now accepts Bitcoin, or now lets you use Bitcoin. And the second they open deposits and withdrawals for Bitcoin, I can send money directly from Strike as dollars. Like, I can just send a $1,000 payment out of my bank account in an instant and deposit it to PayPal. Again, I can go from one payment network, Strike, to another payment network, PayPal, without going back to the bank. And as these payment networks and other services adopt Bitcoin, which they will, none of them are so stupid as to ignore the fact that Square now makes more money selling Bitcoin than they do as a payments app, which is how they started, and it is growing by like 20% per quarter, some stupid number like that. No business that wants to be successful and remain relevant is that stupid and is going to ignore this thing. So as it is added to the next app, suddenly all of them speak the same language. Suddenly they're not walled gardens anymore. And if they adopt Lightning, I can do this instantly and with almost no fee. Now, rather than waiting for days and paying huge fees, I can easily send $10 from Strike to Cash App to Zelle to PayPal to Venmo to my Apple Pay and back to Strike in as much time as it would take to open each app and make the transaction. And even better, I can send it and do this in any country in the world. Now, maybe that takes a lot more infrastructure. Maybe that takes a lot more adoption. But this is the internet of money. This is the next stage of the internet, bringing down the finance and banking giants. There is no market that will ignore that kind of functionality for long. Both the money and the technology exist. They will fight. Somebody will fight to not be disrupted. But there will be startups that use this as their default. Maybe the big players won't adopt it, but the small players who want an edge absolutely will. And remember, in my example, as the customer, I'm sending $10, not, you know, 51,200 whatever sats. I see dollars. I don't even have to know that I'm using Bitcoin. I'm just suddenly impressed that my Cash App, my PayPal, and my Strike app can do so much more, so much faster, for so much cheaper than it did before. Just like my analog phone suddenly doesn't have long distance fees, suddenly neither does my banking app. But I'm still using dollars. I'm still using my corded phone. But the bank, the payment service, is settling in Bitcoin, because that's the only way to make it work. That is how I think Bitcoin becomes a medium of exchange. It becomes, prior to the point where it becomes a medium of exchange, it becomes the Linux of money. It becomes the back-end server that runs every computer on the internet. It becomes the back-end money that runs every bank and payment system, because it simply does the job better and with less friction. And understand, the only thing that has to allow this to happen is everything that's been happening for years. It simply has to not stop. The longer Bitcoin survives and continues to do its job, the longer the infrastructure and the markets continue to grow exactly like it has, the longer development and improvements keep coming to the Lightning Network, which drop every week, it seems like, the more and more likely your dollars in the near future will only move like your emails, because Bitcoin enables it to do so. Now, I've got a final thought that I want to hit before we close this thing out. But before I do, I just want to thank our sponsors again for the show. GuySwan.com/Hexa will get you to the Hexa wallet, which is a great mobile wallet for anybody who has yet to really hold their own Bitcoin. You know, make sure you're buying Bitcoin on a place that you can withdraw from, like Swan Bitcoin. SwanBitcoin.com/guy actually gets you $10 free. Don't miss out the opportunity. But Hexa is just a great mobile wallet, and I'm a huge fan. Thank you to them for supporting the show. And of course, Bitbox. The Bitbox is a wonderful, sleek, minimal hardware wallet that is open source and Swiss built with security in mind. And they are also supporting Bitcoin Audible. And you can check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox. That'll take you to my personalized page with a great little quote at the top. Or at least I'm proud of it. I think it's a good quote. All right, so this brings us all the way back around to our original point. Schiff said there's no real use for Bitcoin. All you can do once you buy it is sell it, but you need somebody else to buy it from you. And the last part of that was, it's a massive pump and dump. Part of this is correct. This is and always has been the case with money. Anybody who ever bothered to go learning about it would understand this. As for it's a massive pump and dump, this is actually partially true as well. There are plenty of ignorant fools who get into it without learning anything about it and think they're just going to make a whole lot of money, and then they're going to dump after they do. They have weak hands. They don't dig into it. But those who do, those who truly understand its potential and the long-term picture of this, what unbelievable assurances it can provide, and what the future holds, they buy the hell out of those weak hands who dump. And those pump and dumps, the dumps themselves, never fully retrace the pump. None of them have even been sustained for 2 years. And here we are yet again. The same conversation over and over again. Bitcoin a breaths away from the all-time high, a stronger and more liquid market by an incredible magnitude than any time in its history, a beautifully relevant macro case for a high valuation, more usability and functionality that many said could never even work, and it gets better by the week. Bitcoin isn't a pump and dump scheme for speculators. It is a pump and replace scheme for the financial infrastructure of the freaking world. And it will take decades to build it out, but there's nothing fundamentally that we can't build on top of it, and I don't see anybody slowing down or stopping. I see everybody building as hard as they can go and adding incredible functionality, new liquidity, new financial tools, and new services on top of this thing. And until I see that changing, it's not going anywhere. And for people like Peter Schiff, it will continue to not die and continue to keep growing until they are red in the face with frustration. The real reason we are still having this conversation is because it just won't die and it won't go away, and it drives people who don't understand it crazy. Now, all of this said, it's perfectly understandable to be skeptical. Skepticism is actually the only healthy response before you actually dig into it, learn about it, and know what the hell the thing is. So I don't hold it against any of the outside observers. Schiff, on the other hand, is pushing his ignorance to the limits at this point. It's much more akin to a powerful belligerence than it is honest skepticism, in my opinion. But still, I mean no disrespect. Peter Schiff was very, again, pivotal in the history, in my history, of leading to me to Austrian economics, so he gets a free pass on this one. But for the pleasure of my own ego here, I will add, Bitcoin isn't going anywhere. It's not going to stop growing, in the meaningful sense, not just the short-term price, this week or the one after that. There's massive development and building happening. There's massive adoption, whether or not anybody wants to say it's the right kind of adoption. Ignoring that is incredibly foolish. The price will continue to be volatile for quite some time, but the longer it hangs around, the more likely that volatility continues to be upward. So we can either admit that maybe we don't get the whole picture, and all we've done is take a cheap glance in Bitcoin's direction, and maybe it's time to take a closer look when the bubble seems to reinflate for a fifth time. Or, of course, you can just have fun staying poor. Okay. This was my dear James Woods. Hopefully he listened to some of it. Probably not. But, you know, whatever. Sincerely, Guy Swan, thank you for listening, everybody. I hope you got something out of this. If you did, share it out, subscribe to the show, and let me know what you thought. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan. And until next time, everybody, take it easy. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.